All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, and creatures of various parallel continuities and realities, I'm Loki. George Williams is my given name. I'm the lead Pathfinder designer at Savage Mojo and a freelancer. Work with a number of companies in the industry. And joining me today, we have the illustrious Kevin Andrew Murphy, who I've worked with on several projects for Savage Mojo. And you may know his name from other interesting places like the Wild Cards books. And today we're going to talk a little bit about taking your game across the dimensional divide, and bringing your fantasy group into science fiction milieus, and embracing the sort of storytelling that you see in things like Sliders, the good alternate reality episodes of Star Trek, Stargate, things of that nature. Would you care to offer any opening comments before we dive into the meat of things there, Kevin?
Yes, well, actually, at the same time as Sliders was coming out, George R. R. Martin had a pilot called Doorways, which got burnt off, but later on, Daniel Abraham took it and continued on with it in a comic book fashion. But that was back in the day. The thing is that multiple parallel worlds, it's an old trope. It's been done by various people. Keith Lommers, the World Shuffler.
Heinlein's Number of the Beast, another great example right there. And of course, if you're into old school fantasy and Roger Zelazny, you can't talk about traveling multiple realities without invoking the title Chronicles of Amber.
Yes, and Diana Wynne Jones' Crestomancy series.
Indeed. As far as gaming goes, as an old guard gamer who started back in the late 70s and who plays with a lot of younger people, a lot of Pathfinder Society people and other such, one thing that I do hear is complaints. You can look at community posts and blog posts and such about the Iron Gods adventure path that came out last year, for a good example. There are people like me who love mixing things up, Expedition to the Barrier Peak style. There are people that absolutely hate it and think that there is no place for that in D&D and fantasy games. And while that is what works for you at your game, and that is the most important thing, anyone who says that it's invalid needs to look back to the very beginning of contemporary role-playing games. A brief quote from Gary Gygax from Master of the Game lays it out right from the beginning, the way it was in the very first D&D game onwards. A quick shift of gaming milieu would enable play to move to another adventure better suited to the current player mood. The Old West, a brush with some World War II events, an expedition into New York City, an inadvertent transportation to a starship, or a similar trip to some settings conceived by authors such as Edgar Rice Burroughs or Jack Vance. Anything was possible. In that very first D&D game, when they were developing the game itself back in the 70s, the first party, there was a guy named Don Kay that played with Gygax. And in a lot of ways, he and his character were one of my inspirations for the way I've run my games ever since. Don Kay ran a character named Merland. Merland, you know, you see various write-ups of him over the years. Sometimes he's a paladin, sometimes he's a sorcerer. Whatever. The common thing is that he spent a lot of time somewhere else. And because of that somewhere else, he sported 6 guns and a 10-gallon hat and a sheriff's star. This is even before Boot Hill was published. And as part of the part of honoring the legacy of the now passed Mr. K, every incarnation of the world of Greyhawk has featured escalating versions of Merland. You know, first he's a hero in the old deities and demigods. You know, then he's a minor god. Now he's a god. You know, in my game, he is full on the god of technology in the magical settings because of that. So whether it's to your taste or not, let that dictate whether it's in your game. But you can't say it's invalid. You can't say it's part of the game because it was part of the very first party to play D&D ever. Any thoughts or expansions on that, Kim?
Well, beyond that, it's part of the mythology. You cannot play high fantasy without having mad inventions as part of it. Mm-hmm. Greek mythology has Daedalus in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got flying machines, you've got mazes for minotaurs, you've got, oh, no children are here, we've got, you know, the origin of the minotaur was that King Minos' wife wanted a sex suit to have sex with the bull of mm-hmm. Crete, and Daedalus built that. You know, we are going into not safe for work territory, but it's right there in the mythology. Mm-hmm. And anybody who says, but this isn't fantasy, isn't reading their mythology.
Indeed. Indeed. And as far as gaming goes, if you're taking your game multiplanar, multi-genre, across the dimensional barrier, whatever terminology you want to use as your baseline, I find that one of the keys is trying to keep a level of consistent realism within the setting you've put forth. You know, make it logical, make it work. You know, as Miles Cantor over at Savage Mojo, who created the Suzerain Continuum, put it, you've got to be careful that you don't end up playing for four or five levels and end up the guy from the fantasy world in the super suit with sharks for hands. You know, unless that's what you're going for. You know, a Toon-type game is great, but bits and pieces and logic are really key. And the idea that this is only for high-level play, I think, is a false one. And the great Planescape setting is a really good example of taking low-level characters into the hells, into the heavens, into places they're normally not perceived to being, and making it work. I think that one thing that really helps a lot with that is that you need to, when you're explaining to your party how the game is going to go before everything starts off, mm-hmm. let them know, in this game, combat is not always your solution. These sort of games tend to be a little more thoughtful. Yeah, you're going to have a lot of combat. You know, the big battle in World War I with Rasputin and the whatever that Icebound adventure path was is a great example. But even if you're not going to a parallel reality, you take a first, second, third level character to hell, that should be more about the deals with the devils, making sure you don't mess up with the diplomacy end of things. Obviously, a devil can squash you, but it's far more interesting if you get into more of a classic Faustian sort of scenario with that. And you can amp up the level of combat and violence and other such as appropriate when you're moving up. The higher and higher levels you get, particularly with Pathfinder being a rules-heavy system, you're going to find that, yeah, kind of combat gets very over the top, very epic, to use an often overused word. But focusing a little more on story, intrigue, the ramifications of things. There was a great book back in the 70s called The Doomfarers of Coromond. And in The Doomfarers of Coromond, you had a classic fantasy story. You've got a wizard, you've got a king, you've got a kingdom threatened by a dragon, and so on. And the wizard decides to summon some help. And he ends up with a tank full of military guys straight out of the jungles of Vietnam that show up. And it works, because through the course of the story, they only have so much ammunition. They're running out of it. Your consumables are limiting how much the technology can be used and have an impact on the setting. You've got, I remember the climactic scene with the dragon. The dragon comes up and you've got the figure wrapped in silks, the virgin sacrifice, and as it gets close, suddenly throws off the silks and it's one of the military guys. There's a white phosphorus grenade down its throat, and things kick off. The second book in the series, all that stuff's useless. The tank is out of gas, etc. But you've got one kingdom now that has been learning the ways to make gunpowder and such. And drop a little thing, into your campaign, into your particular setting, and follow the logic of where that would take you. And that's another really great way to work with it at a lower level, and a lower level of hit points as well as skill. Do you find this is fairly similar to the approach in your own games?
Well, it's the approach, but I think I tend to take a very mythological approach. Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, the world hopping, it's the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, here's the Isle of Calypso. Mm-hmm. Here is the Isle of Circe. It's like, if you want to have a different set of magic or a different level of technology or a different level of whatever, you put it on an island. And the island works the exact same way as having, you know, a different dimension. It doesn't matter whether you sail to the next island or step through the looking glass, you're getting into a different world. Mm-hmm. But actually, with what you're saying earlier on having low-level adventures, like, you know, character getting into hell, well, the reason why you can deal with hell is because the devil plays by rules. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, like, if you have a character get into fairyland, that's the very classic thing.
Oh, yeah.
Fairies can squash anyone. But there are rules.
Yes,
there
there's etiquette.
There's etiquette. There is everything that has to be done. And so that's why you can have a chambermaid go in and, just from being polite, will, you know, deal perfectly. Whereas suddenly, high-level adventurer, you're rude, you're toast.
Yeah. You are too egotistical for a mortal. Snap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that... anybody kind of following that path that wants some good inspiration, not only looking at the classic mythology itself, but Neil Gaiman's Sandman is a wealth of inspiration ideas for people wanting to start playing with the fae and other such. I've always been a huge fan of the what they call today the genre mashups. You know, pretty much every campaign of mine, whether it be Greyhawk, The Realms, Galarian, whatever, the poor sods have always ended up spending at least an adventure or two stuck in Gamma World. You know, fighting mutants and radiation and nuclear holocaust type of stuff. If you're not running an entire campaign that's based on that, then one of the keys to making it work is you be sparing with that stuff. You know, here we go, you know, fantasy adventures from first level up to 15th, and then you spring Expedition to the Barrier Peaks on if you're a second edition. Yeah, either that or have it all in there, all collaged together from the very beginning. The Iron Gods adventure path I mentioned before, which is in itself a homage to Barrier Peaks. Another great example. Characters start off from the very first adventure with all the typical fantasy tropes, powers, feats, spells, abilities, etc. And within the first couple of pages, you've got lasers, grenades, and the beginning of a mystery that's all based on an AI attempting to ascend to godhood. Yeah, and that's where you really put a fine point on it when you're blending these things, is when you take elements of two different genres, find an interesting and logical way for things to go in a completely new direction. There's nothing new about the idea of a character or an NPC trying to ascend to godhood. It's a classic trope. There's nothing at all wrong with the science, or out of line with the science fiction trope of the mad AI. You look at HAL in 2001. You put them together and have a mad AI trying to become a new god with a Terminator-style attitude that has no use for organics. You've got a great story. You know, 10 points to James Sutter for coming up with that little twist on things. You know, so take your elements and blend them together and try and think of a unique direction that combining these elements would bring you in. Running my mouth too much, I'll leave it to you to comment next there, Kevin.
Okay, well, you know, classic D&D thing, we have the realm of many worlds.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and there's, you know, as I said, through the looking glass. One of the interesting things is if you're going to be doing the multiple worlds, is what is the method that you use to transition from one to the other?
Yeah.
You know, you can do, it's like, oh, a spell goes awry and there's wild magic. But after a while, that just gets a little bit confusing and so forth.
It's what my wife would call easy weird at that point.
Easy weird. And that's sort of the, you can do that once. One of my rules of storytelling is that Lewis Carroll said, you know, sometimes, you know, the White Queen's going, you know, sometimes I believe six impossible things before breakfast. The rule of writing good science fiction fantasy is you get one impossible thing before breakfast. Mm-hmm. You have the world. It's going along its usual merry way. You can have one odd thing happen, and usually either in the first scene or it happened yesterday off, you know, off stage, and now everyone's going, well, what on earth was that? That, yep. You know, that never happens. You know, the one impossible thing before breakfast will be a good start of the story.
Yeah, and carry that out to its logical extension.
Right. With the expedition to the Barrier Peaks, we have a fantasy world and a spaceship crash lands on it. That's your one impossible thing before breakfast. Every other weird thing going on is tied to that one impossible thing. Mm-hmm. The spaceship landed. If the spaceship lands and there's the demon invasion, you know, and the wizard has come up with a new spell, and, you know,
it's overkill.
It's overkill, and after a while you're like, we've reached wacky land, yes. And
sharks for hands.
Sharks for hands. But, for example, the Sharks for Hands, if you've got the, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, if this was an accident of the infinite improbability drive, you could have it, you know, that happens. Like, okay, we've already, but it's that one impossible thing before breakfast.
Like, it's the same challenge you get with other campaigns, but to a greater extent. You want to make it believable and logical with the axioms of the setting involved. The thing that I wholeheartedly believe that Kevin's 100% right with his assertion that you start with one unusual factor and carry that out to its extension. Because if you really look at a lot of your science fiction, a lot of your fantasy, you know, the great multiple reality episodes of Stargate, of Star Trek, the ones that worked, that is. Mirror, Mirror being a classic example. Mm-hmm. It gets too cluttered if you're introducing too many changes, because the story really doesn't come out of the changes. It comes out of how the culture deals with them, how the characters deal with them, the interesting new directions that one change shifts other things in the setting. You know, I kind of picture it as a game of Othello. You know, you drop the one white piece over here and it flips this row to white, and it flips that row to white, and you've got a completely different playing field. Mm-hmm. But you've only changed one square to do it. Yeah. More than that, you tend to get buried, and it gets all fuzzy, in my opinion.
Yeah. Also, I should probably mention Doctor Who, where it's very much, it's the Odyssey. It's like every time there is it's either going in time back to some historical period on Earth, or going to another planet and, you know, finding something there. But every planet is pretty much, you know, another of Odysseus' styles. Mm-hmm. Here is everything, and there is only one impossible thing on that planet. Mm-hmm. But that's where the whole story springs from.
Precisely. Yeah. And even with Doctor Who, you've got the fine tradition of completely alternate realities. Even though you can go anywhere in time and space in the TARDIS, you go back to, I think it was 1972, Inferno with John Pertwee. It was very much their mirror, mirror story. You know, he's working on fixing the TARDIS console, there's an accident, and all of a sudden he's in a world where UNIT is fascist, the Brigadier is the brigade leader and has no mustache, sort of the reverse of the evil Spock. All the good guys are bad guys, and he's utterly screwed trying to get back to his Earth to fix his TARDIS. You know, and we've seen that in the rebooted new version of the series with the way they introduced the Cybermen in that alternate world with, as seems to be a classic trope with a lot of alternate worlds in the current day, lots of airships and things like that, you know. First sight you see of it is modern takes on the like the R-101 flying between the buildings of London. Yeah, but it works. You know, you could cite sources all day. You know, from Lewis Carroll's wonderful alternate realities, so firmly rooted in mathematics and political satire with, mm-hmm. with Alice and the Looking Glass and everything. The many different islands that Lemuel Gulliver in Swift visited, I think, would actually qualify.
Oh, yes.
Lilliput brought Bingnag, the Laputa, the floating island of navel-gazing philosophers. You know, and it really is good to kind of contain them in their own areas if you're taking that approach. I think you're 100% correct in that, because then you can really take one and push it all the way to the edge without toppling all the dominoes in the rest of your baseline campaign setting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Star Trek did that a lot, where in some ways it also became a little bit of problems, is that the Earth was the only planet that happened to be multicultural. Every other planet was monocultural.
Oh, yeah.
But that part of the reason for that was basically, we're doing the Odyssey, is that we're doing the one impossible thing, is that you had to be able to understand these are the Vulcans, these are the Klingons, these are the Romulans, because of the way they acted, and they always acted the same way, and the planet ended up being a monoculture.
Yeah.
Just simply because it made it easier to deal with. Mm-hmm. Because if we suddenly, you know, ran into Ferengi Girl Scouts, what would you do?
Oh, the image of Ferengi Girl Scouts is going to be stuck in my mind for way too long. Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah.
I actually tried to branch out in Enterprise with the Zindi, because there was supposed to be 6, possibly 7 species.
Yeah, I remember that.
It all ended with them destroying their own planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, despite the many faults that Enterprise had, I think that's actually a really great example to bring up, because while it's not necessarily planar or dimensional travel, once they got rolling around third season or so, the whole thing was it was a temporal chess game going on. There was so much time travel involved. You know, the Zindi are trying to destroy Earth because they have a patron from the future who's told them if they don't, Earth will destroy them. And you know, you've got all of this stuff going back and forth in time, shifting and changing the equation as you go. And that's my meat and drink. You know, I love time travel, dimension travel, alternate reality stories. I mean, that's why I've helped manage Planescape, planewalker.com, rather, for the past 12 years. You know,
they were smart enough to bring the man from Quantum Leap in to begin with and start with the temporal Cold War, since all mm-hmm. Star Trek deal with time travel. But if you go to Trek Yards, mm-hmm. and other things on YouTube where you've had people from the shows, they keep going on. They expect to start off something completely different. It's just we're going to show them back to the same thing they're doing. And that's the thing. They're caught in their own trap. Or as Stan Lee would say, you don't want the story to change. You want the illusion to change.
Well, bringing up Stan Lee brings up another favorite example of mine. And obviously I was up way too late playing card games with the guys from Geekline 415 last night, or I would have brought it back. But Old Guard comic book readers remember one of my favorite series ever. It was called What If. Mm-hmm. Every issue of What If was a different alternate iteration of the Marvel Universe. What if someone else got Thor's hammer? What if the Hulk had Bruce Banner's brain? What if Spider-Man ended up with the power cosmic of the Silver Surfer? And it was always, you know, as he said, one change and exploring the myriad fractal array of ripple effects that one change causes across the board.
And now they've done entire comic books. Now we've got Spider-Gwen. Mm-hmm. What if Gwen Stacy instead of Peter Parker was the one who got the Spider-Man powers?
Mm-hmm. And the entire Ultimate Universe mm-hmm. from Marvel. You know, and both Marvel and DC, I mean, the 52 and Multiversity and Crisis on Infinite Earths with DC. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm actually running a campaign soon that I've been working towards Awards for about 18 years now, Crisis on Infinite Earths, O-E-R-T-H-S, in the five original iterations of Earth and Greyhawk that Gygax proposed in his writings back in the 70s, that's going to be kind of a baseline. And instead of the anti-monitor and such, people are finally going to get an idea of why they keep running into mind flayers no matter which alternate reality they end up in. It's great inspiration. I mean, if you look at the Marvel Universe, the normal regular continuity for the comic book, that's Earth 616. Yeah, which you can even see allusions to in the S.H.I.E.L.D. TV series. Mm-hmm. And I think that's wonderful, you know, especially the fact that, yeah, most, but oh, you know, DC, this is Earth 1, this is where the main con, you know, everybody thinks they're the core world. I gotta give major points to Marvel. No, this is like number 600 something out of a near infinite variety. And that's why I love the Captain Britain series back in the 80s, because Captain Britain was the one hero that was aware of all of the alternates, and the Captain Britain core was one guy on each of the alternates protecting the multiverse, which is a wonderful concept. I need to do in a game sometime.
This talk is amazingly on time for this, because right now Marvel itself is doing their current Secret Wars, inside the third or fourth Secret Wars.
Yes.
So they have a battle world where they've decided to combine all the alternate worlds together to one battle world. They have a world of 1602 and the world of 2099.
1602 was great stuff. Yeah. I think Gaiman's take on the medieval version of the heroes was awesome.
They have zombies in somewhere, and you know they have a place where you can get battle suits on the cheap, and here mutants rule, and the next thing the Sentinels rule it. You know? So they're basically everything I say, the multi-dimensional, multi-planar, out of time, out of dimension, out of just. We're trying to work it all out right now.
Well, that sort of baseline for your storytelling, to steal a line from the Vulcans, it gives you what I want most. It gives you infinite diversity in infinite combinations.
And while there's definitely, and to kind of at the risk of contradicting myself at the same time, while there's definitely a purist idea of wanting your game to be within canon, staying canon, things, which like in the movies, the second you see Peter Parker with organic web shooters, yes, what were they thinking? It's so much in game, but at the same time, you have to have things to be entertained to go outside. Because like just starting with Connecticut Knight and King Arthur's Court, that time travel, and he's messing with the timeline right there in his story, you know, just like Captain Nemo as what. Now we realize the nuclear subs or something that back in the time, you know, a lot of what we call classics is basically, like say, multi-dimensional, multi-planar, multi-temporal, you know, so we would, if we had the classics, we would have gone, because like they established Superman as supposed to be the first comic book superhero, but again, he was supposed to be taken from that guy that was on Mars in the failed Disney movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, so like there's definitely two camps. As they say, one of the definitions of genius is to have two contradictory thoughts at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're basically, the geek and nerd culture is forced to deal with. You got to have your, it must be according to canon. It's like, no, this is just so cool.
Well,
I think that you go with the canon and it's just so cool. I mean, Joss Whedon did that on the wall of the Buffy writer's room, where he says, this is the canon, and it shall not change unless we think of something really cool.
Exactly.
And that's the whole thing of the rule of cool. It needs to be cool enough to break the canon.
Washing the box canon.
Yeah. You can't just do it just on a lark. You got to have something that when you break that wall and you shift away from canon, you're delivering something major that's going to make it worth it for people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a number of years ago, I found a way to do something that most people in geek culture don't really seem to be able to do. No offense to anybody out there, but as far as the whole canon, it's like, oh well, I love the TV series, but I hate the movie, or no, the movie's awful. I love the book, you know, with various things. Long time ago, I just kind of adopted the attitude. Okay, let's take Logan's Run for example. The book has absolutely no relation to the movie. And while it's closer to the movie than the book, there's a massive gulf of difference between the movie and the early 70s TV series. A lot like there is between the Star Trek movies we've had and the new Abrams Star Trek movies. I view each of these as an alternate reality. You know, different mediums have different needs for storytelling. You don't write the same way for film that you write for a book, or that you write for audio, or you write for a graphic novel. So that's one thing that affects it. And there are always going to be some differences, and there's always going to be, you know, to a greater or lesser extent, I'm directing this, I'm writing that, I want to put my personal stamp on it. You know, it's perfectly understandable. I'm an egotistical writer myself. I totally get that. But I just kind of look at it, and it's like, okay, these are all different alternate realities. I like this one, I'll follow it. I like this one, I'll follow it. I like this one, I'm not going to waste my time getting aggravated because this one isn't canon, because it's not forever.
And also, sometimes what happens is something becomes iconic because it gets fixed in the public mindset. For example, Oz, the Ruby Slippers. Mm-hmm. The Ruby Slippers started out in the book as the Silver Shoes. Mm-hmm. It looked better for set design and for costuming and for having everything to pop with Technicolor to have Ruby Slippers, because you could get that bright Technicolor
red. And that sparkle.
And Baum would probably have agreed wholeheartedly because, oh, you know, it says TikTok of Oz originally started off as a stage play that he made with the Oz character.
Really? I had no idea.
Yes, and so it was actually just produced by the Oz Con for like first time in 100 years as a full-on stage musical.
Awesome.
And then he turned it into a novel.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, Polychrome and all the rest of the characters are
nice.
In there, and it's very fun, but you know, we're going to adapt it one way or the other. So if, for example, we decide to get another Oz movie, which picks up some of the stuff from the Oz books and everything, mm-hmm. and at some point when MGM goes into public domain, and you're not going to have to pay ridiculous rights
yes.
for the Ruby Slippers, but basically once everything is in public domain, you've got two alternate universes. You've got one where Dorothy has silver shoes. You have another one where Dorothy has ruby slippers.
And you can take that a step forward, because you've got a third one where you can't really necessarily tell from the, I think it was 10-minute long, black and white film short of Oz that Baum himself shot back in
right.
the dawn
yes.
of the film.
Yes, I mean, I could write up the whole bit as like, okay, and, you know, here's the whole, you know, multicolored shoe alternate variant, sort of like, here's the sapphire slippers, you know, here's the emerald slippers, there's different, you know, there's colors for all...
Oh, do it like the Green Lantern, one for each color of the spectrum, you know, go hog wild.
I just do it for the five colors of Oz, you know, so that would be...
Oh, yeah, for the quarters in the Emerald City.
Right. And then the silver shoes, there's sort of like, is it one pair of shoes to rule them all? But there's
no, oh, I like that. You see, now I'm picturing an Oz Tolkien mashup here.
And the thing is that they are alternate realities, and they work out... Mm-hmm. perfectly well. Actually, it's one thing I saw was an absolutely great, yes, believe it or not, fan fiction thing, mm-hmm. but somebody had, it was called The March of the Mary Sues, where somebody was there trying, having the two gods who were trying to play their wars by one of them making a Mary Sue character and putting them into different universes to make everything to screw things up. And the very best one was where there was the good drow girl who decided to escape the evil cult of Loth by getting into Tolkien, and then somebody had to screw it back up and saying, okay, well, if she can get in, Loth can come in too. And Loth ends up making a deal with Sauron and says, by the way, I'm taking Shelob back with me. You weren't doing much with her.
Oh, I like this already.
Oh, yes.
That's terrific.
But there was just some, you know, brilliant stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, what yeah. if you're going to mash up the universe, it's like, what would logically mm-hmm. happen if we had these, you know, characters
yeah.
come in? I was writing, actually, it was just on Facebook, there was somebody had the rather hilarious bit of the presidential debates, but with Voldemort and Sauron.
Oh, I saw that. Yes. That was wonderful.
And,
yeah.
You know,
that was a ton of fun.
And I had Voldemort's promise, you know, sort of like, how would I end the war on Christmas? I would do it by ending Christmas forever because I have an alliance with the White Queen of Narnia, and I would get her spell of always winter, never Christmas.
Oh, my. Holidays full of nothing but Turkish delight.
Yes, but, you know, if you're going to mash up the universe, oh, yeah. No, this it just says yeah. Voldemort would get along famously with Queen Jack.
Oh yeah,
so
yeah.
Long as she stayed in her own realm.
Yes, yes. You know, until they get acquisitive and eyeing each other's territories, a lot of the great villains would work very well together
they
towards
work
the common
very, end. Very well together, and then you know they might mm-hmm. possibly you know finally unite as king and queen over all the realms. Because you could possibly say, it's like, yeah, I can see what you're doing here.
Well, you know, I think that that Voldemort might very well be one of the few people considered worthy of dating by the White Queen. So you can take that whole route. another one that's really fun, and there are a couple of examples that I'm extremely fond of, is... mashing up a fantasy, science fiction, or other known setting with what we look around ourselves and laughingly term the real world. Back in, I think it was late 70s, there were a pair of short stories that were just absolutely wonderful called A Visit to a Strange Planet, and a sequel to that called Visit to a Strange Planet Revisited. And which obviously came back because the first one was so popular. These were in the early days when you did not walk into a bookstore and see 45,000 different Star Trek titles on the shelves. You had adaptations of the episodes that were out there, and maybe two or three anthologies of original stuff that I think Vonda McIntyre spearheaded. And these were two of those. Visit to a Strange Planet starts off like Mirror, Mirror. Kirk and McCoy and Spock and Scotty are the away team. They get in the transporter and an ion storm hits and their vision blurs as they transfer down and they open their eyes and they're in the transporter bay and there's no wall in front of them and there are lights and cameras aimed at them and this voice goes, Bill, will you quit fluffing your lines? And they're on the set in the 60s. Having swapped places with Shatner and DeForest Kelly and the rest, and they're trying to cover their asses and figure out a way to get back. And then Visit to a Strange Planet Revisited was when the same author went back and wrote about what happened to Shatner and D. Kelly and James Doohan and the rest when they appear on the Enterprise. And they were screamingly funny and really, really true to the characters and that one core change introduced by the switch. Supernatural did this. I forget what season. The Winchester boys end up on the set of Supernatural, and it's great because Misha Collins was hilarious. You know, because you know they go up and it's like, oh, that looks like Castiel, and what is he doing? He's having a Twitter argument with like, Shatner or something, which actually happens all the time because I follow him on Twitter. You know, he's actually commenting. Yeah, they really let me just play myself for this. Which is terrifically fun, you know. So you've got a lot of interesting directions you can go. Dragon 100, when we still had the wonderful, long lamented Dragon magazine, had had an adventure for their 100th issue. The D&D party sent on a quest to search for the Mace of St. Cuthbert, which he hid centuries ago. Well, he hid it in the London Museum on Earth, and they end up in 1979 London dodging cops and mm-hmm. befriending a street urchin, if they play it right, yes. who shows them how to dodge around and escape.
And the nice thing is that, however, the Mace of St. Cuthbert still had its power. If anyone touched it, had to convert to lawful mm-hmm. good.
Yep.
And it was still doing that, but it wasn't breaking reality of the modern age, because there's like, oh, some of the museum curators, who are generally nice people to mm-hmm. begin with,
yeah.
just became, you know, a bit more, you know, stickler of law.
And yeah, this is the way it says we do it in the policy and procedure now, and that's about it for substantive change.
Yes, and so I'll worked out. Probably a few reformers sort of like, oh, that bastard who was going to fire everyone.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful stuff. I still have that issue. Mm-hmm. You know, one of these days, I gotta upgrade that to Pathfinder and run a party through it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one reason that I think I don't know that it was the most popular setting by a long shot, but that's one reason I really enjoyed Urban Arcana and the various flavors of D20 Modern. Mm-hmm. Was because it was a lot like in the old days of second edition D&D and original Gamble World. Mm-hmm. The systems were so close together, you could basically jump from one to the other with almost no conversion necessary. Mm-hmm. And with the D20 Modern stuff in the equation, you had the toolbox to be able to drop your characters into mm-hmm. the modern day, drop your characters into... the Caribbean, you know, you want to take them to the Caribbean to go and hang out with Jack Harkness on Tortuga, you know, mm-hmm. or Jack Sparrow, rather. I'm sorry, I was thinking of Barrowman's character in Tortuga.
Well,
there.
Heck, you can also mash up those two characters because they get along famously.
Oh, God, the idea of Jack Harkness and Jack Sparrow running loose in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And as we get more into the non-safe for work portion of that, it's like, yeah, I can very easily say that because, I mean, come on, a bunch of pirates on a ship alone without women together, and the way Jack Sparrow swishes around, I can see the two of them dating.
Either way, Miley Cyrus probably had a crush on either one of them.
Pardon?
Either way, Miley Cyrus would probably have a crush on either one of them.
Well, that's bringing more time travel in as well. Yes.
She did recently come out and say she's pansexual. So you know what that means? She's a closet hoovie.
That is the first time I have heard that as a rationale for being a Doctor Who fan. I've got to admit, that tickles me.
But how many people here do you think I have to actually know what the phrase pansexual was before Captain Jack came out as pansexual?
Probably a lot more than you think, I would wager.
Okay, great.
You know, but then again, I'm from New Orleans. I get subjected to a much greater range of people and preferences than many others do.
This is the Bay Area, but I live on the East Bay side. I'm sure a whole lot more people understand pansexual on the other side. But for most people never even heard the word pansexual until Captain Jack came out. So.
Well, I think it's a case...
I'm Montana's a Captain Jack fan.
I'd say it's more a case of... Captain Jack was a matter of the writers going, oh, let's just go ahead and talk about what, you know, everybody already talks about. You know, it's not going to be a novelty to put in a gay character or a bisexual, whether it's like, and it makes perfect sense with Captain Jack.
Oh, yeah.
Captain Jack is more than just homosexual, bisexual. He's basically, he made it into like a guy joke. He actually said in interviews, he'll have sex with plants, he'll have sex with...
Oh, yeah.
He's omnisexual.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about Captain Jack is that it is impossible to write Captain Jack slash fiction that is not just proper fan fiction of Captain Jack.
You know, I never thought of that, but that's a great observation. I really like that. But before we end up turning this into a talk about... sex and sexual preference in fiction and gaming, which, you know, I think I might have to do a panel on that now.
Right, but honestly, that is part of it. You know, if you look at fan fiction, slash fiction is an alternate reality where the characters are gay and you're having, you know, characters who would never have sex in the canon universe are doing it in this alternate reality.
Oh, like all the Kirk Spock stuff that's out there.
This, that and the other, or the Sam Dean stuff, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, you cannot write a Captain Jack story where Captain Jack has sex with... That is just straight Captain Jack.
Yeah, it's like, wait, this is Jack. How is that shocking?
Right. No. You have to write Captain Jack abstinence fiction to have it be non-fact.
Now, that's a nifty alternate take on things. Drop someone into a Doctor Who universe and they run into the Captain Jack who has taken a vow of celibacy.
How do you know that's not Captain Jack?
That's your one change right there. See where it goes.
recognizes. I know some of the Doctor Who writers that may drop that in their ear, because honestly, John Barrowman would have a hell of a time.
Oh, he'd have a fun time.
You know, sort of like, you know, what's happened with this mirror universe? Everything is the strange, is the same, right. Except that Captain Jack has vowed celibacy and is keeping it. And has always been celibate.
Oh, that's just wonderfully hilarious. That's what I love about panels like this. You know, you get a question from the audience, takes everything all the way over into left field before it circles back.
Well, it's not even left field. It would be perfect. The thing is, that is your one impossible thing for before breakfast. You know, we have established a Doctor Who universe. Captain mm-hmm. Jack is omnisexual.
Mm-hmm.
You change that one thing. If it were any other character mm-hmm. being, you know, a celibate monk, it would be completely ordinary.
Yeah, it's a small change.
But Captain Jack, it's like, no, that's mm-hmm. the
axiom.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like a... Hello, sir. It's kind of like, you know, having the... Grant Morrison's in fools, but none of them use magic, mm-hmm. you know. But yeah, so the whole idea of, you know, take your one change and spin that out to all its logical conclusions, that really is the most important thing from a game master standpoint when you're developing your own alternate take on things. Another really nice example, and one that I've used in-game that works really well, is back in the last couple of years of Dragon Magazine, they did an article called Greyhawk 2000. And it was the city of Greyhawk that all the old-school gamers know and love 2,000 years after the original timeline. So at this point, the original city of Greyhawk is one little tiny area in the mega complex that's grown up. You've got guns, you've got airships, you've got trains, you've got corporate consortiums and other such, but it's all been a solid and direct evolution of everything you knew. The Shieldlands and Kaolin, if I remember correctly, had now unified into one kingdom, ruled under by a descendant of Azun the Fourth from the old days. And it was fun and interesting because it did something that I think is important to try and do here and there when you're carrying out these extensions.
Yeah.
Yes, it's modern day in Greyhawk, so we want to have guns and such. This is a culture where you've got magic. It's a culture where you've got a lot of things that don't exist and don't influence the evolution of society, weaponry, etc. in the way that it happened here. There are a lot of people, let's just carry it out the way it happened on Earth. One thing I love about this guy, he did guns. They're more like gauze guns or flechette pistols from science fiction than the guns that we know. And they use a low-grade magical effect to build up a magnetic charge and shoot projectiles railgun style, even though they're pistols, rifles. It's a tiny thing, it's subtle, but little things like that, it's like the seasoning on a dish when you cook it. It's the little things like that that give it verisimilitude, that make it more real, logical, and consistent within the setting. Over to you for a moment. I'm going to take a sip of water because I'm obviously losing my voice a bit.
Yeah. Other thing is, I think we should get back to the original thing of having the multiple world hopping. What's interesting is sometimes when you have characters where they are... Well, it's the Odyssey. Is that mm-hmm. you suddenly have gotten so far from home and you have to keep going from aisle to aisle to aisle or world to world to world in quest of home.
Yes, the Sliders, Voyager, Lost in Space sort of trope.
And you keep finding a new universe. And mm-hmm. this, and part of why this is actually extremely good for a role-playing game is that it gives every character a motivation. Mm-hmm. And that motivation, well, is there's no place like home. Mm-hmm. Wizard of Oz is the same thing. Is that Dorothy is picked up from her home, thrown into Oz, and Oz is a really interesting place, but it's not home. It's not home, and so she's got a reason to go on the quest, and is going through multiple different countries of this, you know, strange land while she does so.
And I would add, as a small aside to that, that sort of approach, while yes, the lost trying to find your way back can be considered a little bit trite by some people, it has one massive advantage. If you've got a group that is heavy into the role play side, which is my favorite, the collaborative storytelling, improv acting sort of side, a group of people thrown together and dumped into a parallel universe who are bouncing around trying to find home gives you one of the few really solid, these are the only people who get it, rationales to let you really mix up alignments and interactions. You can have a party that has a functional reason to stay together and work that is comprised of evil characters and good characters and neutral characters that has a much greater chance of retaining cohesion in a campaign-length scenario than many others would, because it's got logic and verisimilitude. These are the only other people who get it, that we may need them to get home. Who knows if we can get back? We don't have everybody who left in the beginning. So it's definitely a much better rationale than, gee, we met in a bar and got hired by Elminster. Gee, let's go. You know. So I think that's a great, great advantage of that approach.
Mm-hmm. And the problem is once you finally get home, there's very often it's like, no, but most of these people would never want to see each other. It's like,
yeah.
Gilligan's Island, if the, you know, castaways had gotten home, you really don't see any of them hanging out together other than, obviously, Mr. and Mrs. Howell, who are married.
Yeah. I don't see Gilligan having watercress sandwiches with the Howells,
I expect that what would happen is Mr. Howell would maybe, like, host a once-a-year reunion for them to, you know, talk about things.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, you know, what goes on, you know?
Yeah, entirely different social strata, entirely different income levels, geographic location, etc. Yeah, once you remove the rationale, there's no reason for party cohesion, shall we say?
Yeah, no reason. It says you could expect that Marianne might go out to visit Ginger, you know, for something, but that would be like, okay, weekend guest.
Yeah. Yeah. So any thoughts or questions from out here in the sea of people listening to our talk?
First off, I would just like to commend you guys for giving such an interesting, fascinating talk. I've never been in such a room full of people who have so quietly, intently listened to your entire talk. I mean, I've never been in a room that's just so.
Your sense of humor is almost as demented as my own, sir. Kudos.
Yes. And we gotta keep the people online breathing. But anyway, do you think there's a quality of irony in the fan base? Because the fans are, of course, the ones that are always holding to Ken the most, saying you cannot break Ken. But from the fan base, brings the fanfickers. Who have gone off and done something completely out of canon, but pushed it so long, they've actually had a word invented called fandom. Like in Star Wars, they actually have a form of lightsaber combat where the Jedi Knight or Sith figures out how to turn their lightsaber on and off just to get past the defenses enough to make the killing blow, which apparently came from a fan figure. But they kept pushing so much, it actually became what they call fandom, where they decided, we're going to make an actual canon.
I will actually say that Splinter of the Mind's Eye, which was one of the
Alan
novels,
Alan Dean Foster,
did have the lightsaber. You could basically adjust things down to you got just like a penknife lockpick.
That was the first non-movie Star Wars stuff out there. That was the first fiction novel outside of
and I believe that goes under semi-canon. I can actually speak to canon. I write for Wild Cards for George R. R. Martin. And George has the rule of the only thing that is canon for the universe is the books themselves.
Yeah.
We have had some comics adaptations. We are now having three graphic novels. I've written one. Melinda Snodgrass has written another. Carrie Vaughn's written a third. And they're in the middle of being illustrated and so forth. But those, you know, as much as I love them, George is going to be saying is these are non-canon, but there's also, there's the non-canon and there's semi-canon. There's also Daniel Abraham did a graphic novel a while ago, and I wanted to use something from him. He says, well, that's not canon, but just because it's so hard to keep the whole book straight. But I also originally did a game adaptation for Aces Abroad, and some of my characters from them have been brought into the official universe, so now they are canon. So the non-canon sources are still semi-canon, in that they are things that can be mined for the official universe.
Well, non-canon can inspire future canon.
It can inspire future canon, but also as for what breaks canon, I mean, occasionally we also get the Highlander 2 effect where, but this is like, if we're going to say all the movies are canon...
I'm sorry, I have to break in and say this. Highlander, there should have been only one.
Right, but they basically decided that the Highlander movie happened, and then the other movies didn't happen, and then the TV series happened, and basically the TV series, the canon of its chronology...
Yeah, that includes the last Highlander movies from what I heard.
Right, and basically is that you look at some things and you're like, this movie, it just didn't count. Okay, we're not going to do that. But then there's other things you can look at, you know, okay, we really liked something that was done in a movie, and so sometimes you will mine the non-canon, the movie you decide to be non-canon. Yeah. Everything about this sucked, except for this one thing that was really cool.
So let's keep that and ditch the rest. We're about to see that happen with the Aliens franchise as well. Neil Blomkamp, who did District 9, is doing the next Alien movie produced by Ridley Scott. And it's going to be Ripley and Hicks and Newt. Alien 3 and 4 never happened. It picks up right after Alien. You know, so again, you've got that split creating a literal alien multiverse now. You've got the kids died, she ended up on Fiore 167, and whatever it is Blomkamp does, which I'm looking forward to because I love his work. I think that from the canon end, that that's a fantastic explanation. I think there's another point to bring up in response to your question. And that's the what I consider, and everything here is my opinion, except for the stuff Kevin says, of course, the idea that any fandom is a monolithic construct that shares a single ethos or idea beyond the love of the source material. Because that's... It's so utterly wrong that it's laughable. I mean, you know, you look at people who play D&D, and you've got the rabid screaming edition wars. Oh no, this is the only true game. No, 4th edition or nothing. No, 3.0, hey D&D. Nah, only the white box is real D&D, etc. They all love D&D. You've got a vast multiplicity of conflicting opinions. And it's the same, I think, with pretty much any of these things. It's not so much that this is the way everybody thinks as these are the opinions where either the most people out there seem to embrace them or the loudest and most vocal people out there tend to embrace them.
Can I ask a follow-up question? Do you feel that copyright versus Creative Commons in the way in which work is protected or not protected deliberately affects how canon can be constructed?
I think that copyright certainly does. I mean, earlier we're talking about, you know, if I Oz is in public domain, if I want to write an Oz story, however, I cannot use Ruby Slippers because the Ruby Slippers came from the MGM movie, and that is very much in copyright and has a whole bunch of lawyers. Yeah. So I have to do Silver Shoes, and I have to do various other things, and if I tread anywhere near, you know, the MGM thing, it has to be stuff like, well, we can sort of see that, you know, as an invention, but not those little things that are very, very clearly pegged and their lawyers are going to defend. So, yes, copyright changes things. This also is why a number of things are created. Flash Gordon, or actually Buck Rogers, was created as a ripoff of Flash Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
And, Zorro was because they couldn't get the rights to the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Yep.
But Scarlet Pimpernel, okay, we'll have somebody doing Scarlet Pimpernel stuff, but he's going to be a Spanish noble instead of a British noble, and we're going to be doing it in New Spain. And the Zorro movies are awesome. You
yeah.
take something, we're like, well, we can't write about that, but we can write about something very similar to that. And you can also then have homages, you know, to various things like Wild Cards. We've got the character Carnifex, who has the regenerative powers and basically has the same powers as Wolverine. But Len Wein, who's the creator of Wolverine, is a friend of all the Wild Cards writers. And so John Miller had an amusing bit where he had Carnifex being from Michigan State and was one of the Michigan State Wolverines and wearing a Wolverine
yeah.
shirt at one point. Because, you know, we can go ahead and lampshade this, but there's a certain amount of good fun and there's also a certain amount of, you know, stealing. And you
yeah.
have to, you know, homages are one thing.
Outright theft
is another. But also, you know, people with regenerative powers, I mean, that's been around, you know, forever.
Prometheus'
yes.
liver
yes.
grows back
yes.
every
Prometheus.
Morning after yes. the eagle rips it out, for God's sake.
It takes about a few thousand years or so, but regret if you don't mind on that. Mm-hmm. So post-publication affecting canon. So you've authored your novels, you've created your game,
mm-hmm.
and then the use of things on the internet, post-copyright, mm-hmm.
right.
or without copyright.
Yeah.
See, I draw a complete line. I don't care how talented the fanfic is, I think it's that's yeah. nice to keep it yourself.
Yeah.
It's a masturbation, honestly.
well, you know, there is a certain extent to that, but sometimes the weird turn pro in that I started out writing for Wild Cards. I read the Wild Cards books. I thought it was a lot of fun. Then I found that there was a gig for writing the second Aces Abroad game book for Steve Jackson, and so I managed to get that, intending it to be my Baby June number to audition for George. And while he hadn't, of course, thought of it that way, I meant it worked anyway. He fell in love with my characters and jumped me into the gang so he could play with them. Because George is, you know, George is an old school gamer. And Carrie Vaughn, who's one of our authors, she wrote Wild Card fanfic in high school, and she says that we'll never see the light of day. But we know that, you know, at some point she'll probably be like, well, this character was really cool, or some, you know, bit for one of her stories. She'll mine little bits and pieces of that. And so a whole lot of fanfic, it's a great example of Star Trek. There's somebody who, I don't know the author, but wrote a Star Trek novel as fanfic, and people said, wow, this is really good, you should send it in. So sent it in, and was so clueless that he thought that he had to pay them, and he was like, no, we're supposed to pay you. So they bought it, and, you know, this is actually a really good Star Trek novel. And so it became canon, and or at least as canon as the novels are, but then the novels are mined for the show. And then you get things like, you know, somebody deciding to write Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
Mm-hmm.
Is this fanfic? It's in public domain. Jane Austen can't sue you. So what is fanfic? What is literary fic? I mean, people have gone around and... Actually, let's go. Chaucer, fanboy. Chaucer wrote The Wife of Bath's Tales, which is an Arthurian. It is an Arthurian fanfic. Chaucer was not writing for publication. He had a good job working, you know, at the customs agent in London and was writing poetry, shits and giggles.
Yeah.
And so that's fanfic. you're writing, I'm going to write an Arthurian, and then here's the wife, actually, she wrote one wife about tale, I don't like that too much, I'm going to move it over to the Shipman's Tale, and he, like, hadn't re-edited, so there's parts where the Shipman calls himself a daughter of Eve or something like that, because it was early wife of Bath, and then, like, oh, this, I have a better wife of Bath tale, and so wrote the wife of Bath's prologue, wrote the wife of Bath's tale, which is a full-on Arthurian, which is also really neat in that it's also written in the wife of Bath's voice.
And has no relation to any documented Arthurian legendary ever there being Mallory's...
No. It's the tale of Sir Gawain and Dame Ragnall being retold by the wife of Bath. She puts her own spin onto it, but it is the tale of Sir Gawain and Dame Ragnall.
I sit corrected.
So, as wonderful as that is, I just want to say I'm not trying to discuss the validity of fanfic or other. I was just curious whether we should consider post-copyright things as necessary for time. Or whether it really
as necessary.
Whether there's any compelling reason to take something as authors and creators, take something that's good and doesn't work its way into canon in a non-financial way.
Okay.
Something makes better sense the way a fan, would you incorporate that?
Okay. Well, the thing is that if this is the other problem with fanfic. As an author and a creator in, you know, official universes and everything, is that I cannot see fanfic. Basically, I'm not supposed to read the fanfic, because if I read the fanfic and then used it, someone could sue me for having stolen their original idea, and sometimes people get very litigious, even though sometimes, like, you made a character who's super strong and flies. You know, there's a lot of people who do that. Cough, Superman, cough. No, my character is completely original. So sometimes just don't want to get bogged down. There's plenty of people's arguments that have no merit. But also then there's sometimes where you read something that's like influenced, and I was like, oh, that is a kind of a good idea. And then, you know, 15 years later...
Yeah, when I remember the source...
I can't remember the source. It's like, was that in one of the unpublished manuscripts of one of my fellow writers, or was that in one of the early drafts that was left on the cutting room floor? Because we have to cut things, and, you know, so after a while, it was like, oh, wait, that was the really cool fanfic I read on the web, and that's somebody who has not become part of the official universe, and so you get problems with that. Now, if everything is in public domain, you know, it's like, you know, and my Oz fanfic and your Oz fanfic, and we're all writing this, in some ways you get better things with, like, the Lovecraft mythos, which is basically a public domain shared world.
Yeah, the first shared world, if I'm not mistaken.
Not counting things like Arthurians.
Well, I'm thinking more straight up fiction than classic myth, really.
So, right. Yeah. But,
so I guess I'm drawing a line in a different place.
But it all works out the same way. I mean, there's lots of you know, where the fanfic begins and ends, and there's, I remember Bill Wu was telling me that he loved being an author because there's actually one of the Chinese gods. They can point to the place where he actually started as a character in some literature. Somebody wrote a popular story. They got so popular that 200 years later he had become an official god and is now one of the gods of the Chinese pantheon, with some character that somebody came up with for a novel ages ago.
Yeah. Another interesting thing about the whole copyright fanfic Creative Commons thing. For one thing, canon is a bit of a slippery animal. You know, for instance, talk to Doctor Who fans. You talk to one fan, only that which was on screen is canon. You talk to another, oh no, that and the books and the comics and everything else. And you talk to another, no, only what was on TV and the Big Finish audio productions, because it has the original characters. Really, the idea of canon is something that's become a little more slippery and amorphous, and I would argue that actual canon, as opposed to what I tend to think of as opinion canon, only exists in the series Bible for Doctor Who, that the writers have to refer to continue with that example.
However, I will say that even the series Bible is not canon. I have read series Bibles, I have helped to write part of series Bibles, and every once in a while it's like, this is the series Bible, one point, someone's like, you know, this thing in the Bible Has it ever actually come into the series yet? No.
Did you?
We came something much cooler. So, line that out, keep it in the Apocrypha that we can mine later if we need to. But, you know, the new canon is this, because, you know, the canon for wild cards is what has been on the page. Everybody sends out character sheets and explains things to people and so forth, and then saying, like, my character has brown eyes. You wrote it as blue. We didn't catch that. Nobody else wrote her as having brown eyes. So we're going to just change this in the Bible because it's in print. She now has blue eyes. No one has ever seen that she has brown eyes other than the notes to the authors. It doesn't make any difference for the storyline. We've occasionally had, you know, little continuity glitches, and we sort of, you know, like, little hand waving here, and later on, if we need to, we will go ahead and say that this is, well, remember, this story was being told by the character, so she's an unreliable narrator here. You know,
you gotta love that.
You know, would somebody lie about their superhero origin? Oh, yes,
oh,
they would.
Yeah, but what I was starting to get at before before we really got off on that is that there's another aspect to that that I think is an important thing, and as someone who is a big supporter of Creative Commons and the type of artistic collaboration that it allows, I think that whether you consider it canon, whether you consider it good, whatever else, there is a very important part of the modern creative ecosystem that fan fiction and that sort of thing fills. And I'll give you a direct example off of one of my teams. I've been manager of Planeswalker.com for close to 12 years at this point. One of our highest profile community members on Planeswalker wrote an ongoing series of forum posts over several years called Shemeska's Story Hour, based on Shemeska the Friendly Fiend in Planescape, which is Wizards of the Coast copyright post-TSR, because they own Planescape. We were allowed to play in that pool as the official site. He did ongoing fiction, updated every week. Wonderful, fantastic stuff. Purely fanfic. If you play Pathfinder, you've got a real high probability you're familiar with this person, because that fanfic, that storytelling ability in a multiplanar milieu is what brought Todd Stewart to the attention of Paizo and had him be the guy to write the planar book for them, to be one of the major contributors to most of their books on demons, devils, inner planes, creatures, etc., etc. So when you talk about fanfic, it's not just a matter of quality and copyright, but it has also become, you're going to see 99% of anything is crap, as someone has said. I think it may have been Churchill. But you've now got a place where people can put stuff out there and give them, if they're good at it and if they can get the attention, a bootstrap up into doing it for money, for a living, you know, as their gig, to be able to achieve the dream of writing for games or writing for fictions based on those humble beginnings with fan fiction. Because instead of sitting in a notebook in your closet like it would have in the 70s or the 80s, it's usually now on the internet where anybody can see it.
And also, I know some fairly well-selling authors who, some editors I know, discovered them by looking on a fanfic site where everyone was saying, like, oh, wow, this Anne McCaffrey fanfic is really good. Wow, we need to hire her and say, can you write dragons in your own universe?
Mm-hmm.
Why, sure. And I won't say which authors and which editors, but, you know, there.
If we told you, we'd have to kill you.
Yeah, we'd have to told you to kill you. And also, that's their stories to tell. But yes, it really, really happens. You know, or let's put it this way. It may be considered, you know, fan wank, but if it gets you hired, who cares?
Yeah.
So, audition. And I think we should probably, not quite on that
note. Are we coming to the end of our time? Or?
Yeah, I have to set up for the next
All right.
Week. Okay.
Well, any quick questions?
On the subject of fanfic going to real, the current big everybody's got involved with the zombies. And the Bay Area, a zombie is an alcoholic drink from the previous generation, a darn good one. So fanfic that involves drunken zombies because they got alcohol, that's the realm, not to mention why some zombies are running around like truckers on meth, because they got meth, it's not around. And guess what happens on Z Nation? You got zombies on Viagra. So no doubt somebody's doing some fanfic somewhere, went up the chain, food, and somebody over in Iowa. It's a good idea.
Well, I don't know that I would say that actually, is obvious so much as the also the possibility of a parallel evolution of a decent idea.
I will also say Z Nation, that's Mike Cassidy, who's one of the other Wild Cards writers. So,
I think we've hit the end of our time. Thank you guys so much for coming in and listening to us. Kevin Andrew Murphy, ladies and gentlemen. Uh-huh. And I'm just Loki. Feel free to hold boos and hisses till I get out of the room. Have a lovely time at the con, ladies and gentlemen.